This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by GhostBed.com. Sit back, relax, and grab a fucking drink.
If you're dragging through your days, ditch the cheap coffee and sugar-packed energy drinks for a Navy SEAL-approved source of energy, CardoMax Energy Intensifier, owned and operated by former Navy SEAL Sean Matson. CardoMax's Energy Intensifier has B3, B6, B12 vitamins, caffeine, and BCAAs that'll keep you dialed up to a 10 through your workouts, early mornings, and long afternoons. Use the promo code DB for 30% off your next four orders at CardoMax.com. That is CardoMax.com, helping you achieve your max. Welcome to Drinking Bros. Kids, whenever we have a great guest that is breaking a story that we're like, man, that's awesome. That's life-changing. I've never heard that before. We try to get him back on. Dan, you did this interview last time, but today we have David Uzak on the show again for some crazy shit. Did I fuck up his name?
Already.
Yeah, you bet I did.
We're like 3 minutes into the show and you've already... He just told you.
I'm not even close. We're a minute and 15 in, Dan. It's like, already fucked it up.
It's like music, but with a Y.
Yeah. Music. You bet.
So
I will never get it, dude.
No, you're the worst.
I'm the worst, dude, at names. I can't even pronounce my wife's name. So,
well, who needs to, right?
We're good. Luckily, it's just Jesse, where I'm like, all right, well, great. Is that short for anything? She goes, no. And I'm like, all right, rad. Yes, you know, I named my kids Jax, J-A-X, so I wouldn't fuck that up. Because everybody's like, oh, is that short for something? No, it's not.
It's short because I can only pronounce three letters at a time.
That's it. That's all I can do.
So David Uzak, former Miami police officer. I think a lot of you will remember him and this incredible story about Richard Flaherty, who is the smallest man ever to don a uniform in the United States military, at least. So
yeah.
He was a captain in Special Forces during Vietnam. And then... there was a great deal of information in the book, The Giant Killer, mm-hmm. about Richard's service in Vietnam and then afterwards with the agency. And after the book came out, and I'll let David tell more of the story in a second, but after the book came out, apparently somebody from Richard's past reached out and filled in some of the blanks. And that's what we're here to talk about today. In addition to that, after this... after our interview with David now, you'll be able to hear the audio of that conversation with this former agency operator for the first time.
Ever. David, we appreciate you being on the show, and we appreciate you giving us the exclusive clip to this. I love where you're at. It looks like a St. James Street James layer there. Big fan of it. Where are you at today?
I'm in Miami. I just... put up a little screen so you guys didn't have to look at my kitchen.
I like it. Look, it looks like you're in Aspen. Just to, you know, you just got off the slopes. You're enjoying a nice hot cup of cocoa and enjoying your life. First of all, let's start with where you're from and how you got started. I think before we went on air, you said you were a former Miami police officer.
Yeah, I work for the city of Aventura. Actually, I started my career actually in Surfside, which, you know, I used to tell people I worked in Surfside and they're like, I never heard of it. Now, unfortunately, from that building collapse, people know about Surfside. Right. And sadly, I was in that building many times. I was there for about a year and then I transferred to another department in Miami called Aventura. What happened was Miami broke up into its own little jurisdictions. And initially, we had the Miami police. And then every little city that popped up said, hey, I want my police to handle these special problems. And that's kind of, Miami's broken up into hundreds of little territories now.
Yeah, it's one of those cities that is so massive. I think it actually benefits the city itself that it is broken up into little territories, because I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, originally, and that city is not broken up into little tiny territories, and they're just getting crushed by crime right now. Is that what you found in Miami?
Yeah, I really think it does help, because, you know, different neighborhoods do have different needs. So, you know, if you have a one size fits all police department, you know, some people are going to have great service and some people are going to have terrible service. So a little bit better that I understand. I'm only working in that neighborhood, that 5 square mile neighborhood. I understand who the people who belong there, who the players are, who the dangerous people are. So I have a better understanding, as opposed to I work for a giant police department. They send me out to different zones and, you know, hundreds of miles. It would get a little more difficult.
Are you retired now?
Yeah, I got, unfortunately, I had 2 back surgeries, so they retired me 3 years ago, and just working on recovering.
Well, let's talk about a little bit about what's going on with the police these days. I mean, I think it's almost fortunate that you're retired due to everything that's going on in America and the way that people treat police. We have a huge show called Failure to Stop that's on Fridays on Mike the Cop's channel. And both of those guys are retired, him and Eric Tanzi, and they break down all the cases. But it was important for us, Dan and I, to hire retired police officers to run that show, because they could actually say what they wanted, versus everybody who's on the job now is having a real tough time being honest about what's going on out in the streets. What is your personal opinion on today's police force and how the chiefs and all that stuff are handling this?
So, you know, in a 20-year police career, I saw the pendulum swing many times, left, right, left, right. We love the cops. We hate the cops. I've never seen the pendulum swing this far. To me, this is so unbalanced. This is so that summer of rioting, the summer of defunding police, you know. Cops were telling the public, who are our families, guys, this is only going to lead to disaster. All this talk, all this cop hatred, it's only going to lead to murders rising, crime rising. And sadly, you know, there are a lot of people in really tough neighborhoods. I'll tell a quick story that most people don't even think about. I work for a gang task force where I did go around the city of Miami, picking up people with warrants and stuff. And some of the worst neighborhoods, the most disastrous neighborhoods that me and my team would go in, we'd go in there violently, we'd go in there, you know, because we needed to bring somebody out who was dangerous. I can't tell you how many people came out of their houses to thank us. You know, you don't think about that in these poor neighborhoods. These people say, thank you. This guy was a terror. He was terrorizing us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you see on the media, they grab this one person that's always, you know, in this poor neighborhood, anti-cop. But you'd be shocked at how many people who live in these neighborhoods and just want their kids to grow up and go to schools too are so appreciative. Their voices never get heard on the media. You know, nobody interviews them. It's not controversial.
Yeah.
You know, so, but that's something, you know, I thought people needed to know.
No, absolutely. And, you know, on yesterday's show, Dan made a comment about being in the military of why you would want to do it today, and why you would want to join the military. And sadly, you know, everything that was going on in Afghanistan. Sadly, I think it's the same way with police. What do you tell aspiring police officers who are thinking about joining the academy? Are you honest with them and say, hey, guys, man, you're in for a rough, rough road at this?
Yeah, the first thing I tell them is be a fireman. But
is that true?
Yeah, but
listen. I don't think being a fireman is a choice, though. You're just born that way. Yeah. That's what all the science says now.
Yeah, yeah. So, it always does.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, I've worked for bad supervisors, I've worked for bad administrations, but it's always incumbent upon you as an officer, no matter what crazy stuff the administration or their, you know, if things constantly are changing and everything, it's, you know, how you go out there and do your job personally. I think it's a little more difficult for a military person than not as autonomous as a police officer that goes out on his beat, or how I interact with people. But, you know, no matter how terrible I thought, you know, some of the decision making was, I always try to just be as professional as I could. So, I mean, the world really, really, I mean, the country really, really needs people who care about police work, people who care about going out and doing the job more than ever, because it's the hardest. It was the hardest job before. I mean, when I was doing it in the 20 years, I obviously keep in touch with my old friends, and they're under such a pressure cooker. You know, as an outsider, you know, once you step outside of that police bubble, you have a bigger perspective. And I feel so bad because I can see how much pressure all these guys are under. You have to be perfect. You know, people all the time say that, you know, they can do police work and I can do it. And yeah, that's probably true. The average person for a couple of days can do police work, put them in a car, send them out to a few calls, do that day in, day out, week in, week out, and be perfect. And it's impossible. We're human beings, be perfect, you know? So it's not possible. 99 or 98% of the cops that I know all have good hearts and are out there trying to do a good thing. Are there a few bad ones? Of course, we're human beings, but I don't think it's anything like the media skews police officers.
Yeah, it's a shame.
That's definitely, the data doesn't bear that out. The data doesn't show that there's rampant abuse by police officers. Something like 270 million interactions between police and citizens a year, or something like that. And the amount of interactions that are inconsistent with police policy or ethics, generally speaking, are nominal at best. Mm-hmm. And begs the question, why? Why would somebody spend all this time other than just to generate clicks, right? Or be part of the in crowd, which is kind of both pathetic when you think about aiming that towards public safety. The real reason is the same reason that people use negative language to describe the enemy in basic training back in the day and things like that, is to dehumanize what they consider to be the enemy, right? It's a psychological propaganda tool that is used to make it okay. Like, if somebody is bad enough, it's okay to do bad things to them, mm-hmm. right? That's a principle that is actually true. If somebody is a bad enough person, it is okay to hurt or kill them, typically speaking. Like the Taliban, for example. Fuck those people.
Right.
It's okay to kill them. So if you can make your enemy seem bad enough, then anything you say about them is excusable, and anything you say to do to them is also fine. That's what they're setting the table for, and we see that now with all this the stupid Antifa shit going on in the Pacific Northwest. And I don't know if you saw it today, but Veritas released a video of a high school teacher who has been actively recruiting kids for Antifa in his classroom, bragging about it,
right,
and talking about how he's trying to get propagandize them to do violence. There you go, right?
Yeah, and I saw a post from Zuby. He's up there right now doing some shows.
Yeah, he was just on Rogan the other day too.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah, and he was on. He's got something else coming out soon that it's wild.
Yeah, so he was saying, he was like, man, it's weird being up here because the flags for everything else, Pride, you know, Antifa, everything else, like it overshadows the American flag. They were like, the American flag is the smallest one.
Yeah, the guy is weird. The dude that I'm talking about, actually in the video, one of his students said, hey, that Antifa flag makes me feel uncomfortable. And he told the student, well, that flag is supposed to make fascists feel uncomfortable.
How old are these kids?
They're in high school.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Now, if somebody said that to my high school child, I would beat them to death.
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt.
And leave out just right there in front of the class, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, look, it's good to set an example for your children.
It really is. Now, with you, David, when were you working for the police back there? Because you could have been part of the fun days, I have a feeling.
No, I got in the late 90s, so I missed the most of the cocaine cowboy stuff.
Matter of fact,
you know what? You guys actually just, man, I got to think of the guy's name. I ended up arresting one of the guys from the movie Cocaine Cowboys, one of the actual guys on a domestic violence. John Roberts was his name. And I didn't know who he was. And I was a rookie officer and I was dispatched to a domestic violence. I think he passed. And strange enough, he was also a Vietnam vet. But he's in that movie. He's named in that movie. I remember going to the domestic violence call and his wife was trying to explain to me who he is. Don't you know who he is? Don't you know? And I'm like,
yeah,
you know, and because I'm a Brooklyn kid that just came down to Miami, so I'm a little behind on the info. So I took him to jail, and what a gentleman. Wow. And I was like, he was also from New York, and his name was John Robertson. He was such a gentleman. He was so, you know, listen, there's lots of people that I've arrested and really disliked. And there's people that, you know, they were actually just gentlemen. I'm doing my job. They're doing their job. And I just don't, you know, I try not to take any of that stuff personal. I just wanted to jump back onto the, you know, the disinformation people say about cops. And Dan's 100% right about desensitizing people. And it makes, you know, we're the enemy. The thing I never understood is if you're claiming that cops are dirty and cops are dangerous and they need retraining and everything, then why wouldn't you comply? If you're so afraid of us and we're so dirty, then the first thing everyone should be doing, because they don't want to get shot or beat up by a cop, is comply. But it's the opposite. And compliance is the biggest problem. If you get stopped by a cop and you feel it's unjust and you feel like it's absolutely, you know, for other nefarious reasons, comply. Take your day, get a great attorney, make file a complaint against the cop, do everything you can legally, but do not non-comply and start moving your hands around in weird ways. And it causes just so many issues. So if they're so afraid of us, why are we seeing more non-compliance?
Yeah, and I'll say this. Ever since all this has happened, and right around 2016 when those Ferguson riots started happening is when it kind of really popped off where, you know, police were very, very cautious of citizens and what everybody was going to do and everything else. I became overly cautious when I get pulled over. Case in point, shit, it was about 10 days ago, 12 days ago. I come back from that Iowa, that Field of Dreams game, and I got pulled over. I immediately turn off the car, put the keys on the dash, put my hands up on the wheel, and let everything happen, roll all the windows down. Hey, dude, I don't have anything on me. Here we go. I want them to feel safe as well, because it was about 1:30 in the morning when I got home from that flight, and it's like, dude, you don't know who you're pulling over these days, especially in, you know, a car with tinted windows, a huge, you know, truck or whatever. You're like, dude, I don't know who the fuck.
Well, I think it's I think it's really interesting the way that a lot of people will instruct those that they consider to be intrinsically threatening, that is to say, white men, for example, how to behave at night in public. If a female's around, right? Make yourself known.
Right.
Ensure you're not following too close. All this stuff that's intended to make sure that that person feels safe, because you're both in a very bizarre, so you don't know each other. It's a bizarre situation.
Yes.
Right? And there is the lingering threat of something bad might happen. If you map that onto this situation with police interactions, it's exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And getting upset with an individual police officer and giving them attitude is kind of like yelling at the fucking Walmart greeter because of their hours. They don't set that shit.
Right.
They're enforcing policy. And to be frank, most of the police officers I know go out of their way to not enforce things that they consider to be stupid, which are things that most people consider to be stupid, like minor drug offenses, for example.
Right.
They're like, hey, dude, put that shit on. Get the fuck out of here. Go back to school or whatever. Yeah. Like, I'm not trying to ruin somebody's life because of a roach.
Exactly. And then, you know, the other part of that, too, was I also became more sensitive to what the police were going through, because most cars do have tinted windows. Right. And it is late at night. So there's no way it could be a racial thing. They don't fucking know who they're coming up on with the windows blacked out and everything else. So it's like, all right, great. Here's who I am. Here's you know, all of my information, everything else. I try to make it as easy as possible for them, so that way they feel safer of like, all right, great. I'm not pulling over some drug dealer or something else, because I am sensitive to what the police go through on a day in and day out basis. Again, with most people's windows being tinted, it's not like, in my case, right? It's not like you were looking at me going, oh, I'm going to pull over this guy because I think he's black, white, or whatever race I am. You have no fucking idea. You have no idea until you pull me over. And so I roll down my windows who or what I am. So even that notion of, hey, I'm just going to pull somebody over based on their race, it's hard to see from a moving car in particular. Now, if you're walking down a street or whatever, that's another story. But in this instance, yeah, I've become more cautious so they feel safer. And therefore, I know it'll help me feel safer. Of like, all right, great, man. They're not going to be as pissed off when they come up to the car. And then I also am more honest about what I did. Like in this case, I was speeding. And so when they came up to the car, I rolled down on my shit, put my hands up, you know, keys on the top, and they go, sir, do you know why we pulled you over? And I go, yes, I was speeding. I was trying to get home. I had three canceled flights today. So if you need to write me a ticket, go ahead. I broke the law and this is what it is, and go on about your night. And they were shocked by that. I was like, hey, cool. So shout out to Hayes County Police, but, They also listen to the show, so that helped. Mm. That helped too in the end. But you know, I think if you're nice to them, they'll be nicer to you, and vice versa. I think when you start off combative and expecting the worst and being pissed off for breaking the law, because let's face it, I don't think 99% of the time when you're pulled over, they're trying to get something on you. Like, chances are you really did break the law. You're speeding, yeah. You had a broken taillight or something else. What in your experience, is that generally the case?
So you nailed a couple of things. First of all, when I get pulled over, I do exactly what you described that you do. You know, I don't just stick my badge out the window. Who knows who the hell? Maybe I got a fake badge. There's no arrogance. I get pulled over. My windows are down. My seatbelt's on. My hands are on the wheel. Yes, sir. What can I help you with? Yes, ma'am. What, you know, I want to make them put them at ease as much as I possibly can. That's number one. Number two, you actually found my Achilles heel as a cop, because 99% of the people, they blow through a light, they go through a stop sign, whatever it is, they got a broken taillight, you pull them over, they start yelling and screaming at you. You have a sergeant every day that looks at you. How many tickets did you write today? What, you know, what kind of activity did you have today? It's stats. They look at you, they question you. So the guy who says to me, man, I'm super, super sorry. I 100% went through that light, man. I made a huge mistake. I can't write that guy a ticket. I just, when somebody or, you know, is that honest and, you know, I can't do it. I know other officers, you know, like the motorman, you get hit by a motorman that he's got a quota. You're going to get that ticket. But for a regular road patrolman, I think just being honest, saying, yeah, you know, or just, I apologize. The other thing is, you know, you're saying, you know, why do people get stopped? There's a million reasons why. There's a bolo, be on the lookout for a vehicle. There's a hazard 2 miles up. I'm pulling you over to tell you, you know, we're shutting down the road there. There's a million reasons why, besides punishing you, that I'm pulling you over. So don't immediately assume it's horrible.
Yeah, yeah. And again, honesty is the best policy in that, where it was just like, hey, dude, I was speeding.
I like to talk shit to the cops still, though. Not like in a mean way. I'm just like, you motherfucker, that was a good spot. You fucking got, like, you got me.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna not talk shit. I guess it's not enemy to let that go.
Yeah, yeah.
If
yeah.
I feel like, because look, it's like playing sports or some shit. That's the game. Like he was talking about with the John Roberts, the cocaine cowboys guy.
Yeah,
there's that rule in the mob. You don't run when the cops show up. You don't fucking run. It's demeaning. You go to court, you pay your lawyers, and you see what happens, right? That's part of the game. That's how it works. You don't fucking do that shit.
I think I just like the fact that this is the first time in the show history, out of 1,060 episodes that we've done, that you showed up for a domestic violence call, and you were like, "What a gentleman! What a gentleman! What a nice guy!" Was he in the right or the wrong in that one?
Well, let me just say there was no, you know, signs of, you know, really horrific signs. Of course, you know, if somebody beats up a woman, you know, I'm going to be very unhappy with them. No, it was a pushing, shoving thing, mutual combatants. Most of the time, sergeants want both people to go to take the ride, because we just can't take the risk of leaving them together. And if one party doesn't want to leave, and even if they do agree to leave, are they going to come right back in 10 minutes? And then I'm responsible. Wow, this guy broke her leg, or she shot him. Why didn't you guys take him to jail? So a lot of times sergeant just says both people got to go.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And down in Miami, I'm sure you've seen some crazy shit. What's one of the craziest calls you've been on?
I mean, I don't want to go dirty on you guys.
Oh, this is the show to go dirty, my man.
I mean, I got some crazy stories. I could tell you this is a strange one. Pizza delivery man calls saying that he was trying to deliver his pizza, and a woman opened the door, put a gun in his face. That's how the call goes out. I'm responding. I'm the responding officer. I have a backup. We show up, try to question the people at the front desk about the apartment. You know, you try to get as much information as you can before you go up there and try to make contact and see, you know, you speak to the complainant, the pizza guy. We find out that there is a woman that lives in that apartment, and we knock on the door and she doesn't open the door. And at this point in time, who knows what the situation is? We know there's a person with a gun. The complainant seems reliable. Call my sergeant. Sergeant, we do everything we can to make calls and make contact with the person inside. Is it a kidnapping situation? Is it a suicide situation? You don't know. So eventually my sergeant makes the call. We got to go in. We got to go into the apartment. Somebody eventually got the key. A maintenance guy got us the key. We stack up. We go into our little stack. Unfortunately, I'm the tallest guy. I don't know why I'm in the front of the line. I'm 6'3", and all the short guys are behind me. So I'm the guy who's taking.
I think
the
you just answered your own question there, brother.
Yeah, I guess my service wasn't that valuable. So they sent me in the front of the stack, and I remember it was the apartment was pitch black, and it was a really big apartment. And I remember just, you know, I mean, I'm going to do everything as tactically safe as I can. But if it's my day to catch that bullet in the face, it's my day. It's just nothing. So checking room, pitch black. Finally, I see a light under a door and I'm like, all right, here it comes. So, you know, you got to make entry. I make entry and it's the last thing I ever thought I would see. Let me think of how to describe this.
You can be as graphic as possible.
Yeah,
we
don't care.
So we don't care.
So open up the door, got the gun ready. There's a woman on the bed, spread eagle, with the biggest dildo I've ever seen in my entire life, going to town on herself. The gun's on the nightstand. She looks up at us. There's a stack of cops. I mean, I you know, it's the last thing we saw. One guy grabs the gun, blah, blah. We find out the story. She was drunk. It was Friday night. She was just trying to get her groove on. She didn't order the pizza. The guy kept coming to the wrong door. She got so pissed off, she took her gun and said, you know, stop bothering me. And unfortunately, she had to take the ride, and the dildo was taken as evidence.
Did you let her?
We didn't take the dildo. I mean, that's like something, you know. Shit. You know,
Did you let her finish?
Yeah. Did you let her finish? You beat me to that by a half a second. Yeah.
No. Well, I mean, I think the ambiance was ruined at that point with us being in there. But
or heightens. Look, I think that's a fetish. A bunch of cops bust through the door. That's pretty much how every porn starts.
I swear to God, no matter what she had done up until that point, if she had just looked up and said, hey, guys, give me a minute, I would have walked down and let her.
Yeah.
I don't care if there's a brick of Coke on the fucking table. I'm like, all right, you won that round. Let's get out of here.
Is there any applause back there that we can actually give her? I would have let her finish and just be like, hey, there we go. You know,
it was Friday night. You know, it was a Friday night.
Yeah. Let her go. How big was the dildo? What are we talking, a 2 foot?
Wait, so this is like, this is really a problem for me at this point. Because my understanding from all the research I've done over the years, all the video evidence I've seen over the years, is that when you're a woman at home alone and a pizza guy shows up, you don't end up alone back in the room with a dildo. It's like that shit happens, right?
Yeah, you fuck the pizza guy.
You
fuck the pizza guy.
You don't try to shoot him and then fucking get the cops show up. If the cops do show up, they fuck you or something happens.
Exactly.
Right?
Did you interview the pizza guy? Was he just not good looking enough? What was his sitch?
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't really speak English too well. I think there was some language barriers. Maybe he didn't pick up the cues.
You were literally naming the script.
That's why she pulled the gun the third time he showed up.
It's like, maybe she made the right cues and he didn't pick up on it. And maybe she even got more pissed.
God damn it.
Yeah. Fuck, man. Missed opportunities. I would have let her finish if I were you.
I would have. Hey, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
That's why people hate police right there. It's that. It's not the other shit. It's let her finish. If she's going to town on herself, be like, oh, be respectful, stand, applaud, ask her if she needs some help, maybe a spotter, and let her finish, you know? But back in Miami, you had to have been involved in the drogas. So late 90s down there was, correct me if I'm wrong, probably
Will Smith.
GHB.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. GHB.
Yeah.
It was big at Florida State, too.
I was there for the bath salts where people were eating each other's faces.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was like, that started around 2006, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that was. Yeah. I remember we got a call at a local hospital of a guy on bath salts and real young guy, skinny, maybe 140 pounds. They had him restrained. You know, the call came that he's going wild. And actually, the hospital has their own security. So it's rare that we get called. When I get up to whatever floor it was, the fourth floor, I think, I see security running. I see a nurse with her face full of blood running out of the room. He bit a chunk out of her face.
Jesus Christ.
I get in that room, and at first, you know, I'm just there by myself because, you know, you do wait for backup on some certain situations, and there's other situations where you can't wait.
Right.
You know, you just have to handle whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I go in that room, and he's already broken out of two of his restraints. And he was the strongest human being. I mean, I fought some tough guys as a cop and big guys and all different shapes and sizes. But this 140-pound guy on bath salts, one of his arms was clearly broken. His elbow was snapped because I guess he had to snap his arm to get out of one of the and he was trying to bite. He was kicking. He was breaking metal. It took like four of us to restrain him. That was the only time I was really, really scared, because you couldn't. He was impervious to pain. He was slippery. He was naked. It was a nightmare scenario.
He's like the greased up deaf guy from Family Guy. Yeah.
He was blood everywhere, and he's trying to bite you. You know, you have to throw a shirt over his face because he's trying to. It's just like being in a zombie movie with that bassaw.
Yeah, we've done one, Range 15. We had a quick question here from the audience. War Within 7 is saying, I live in a constitutional carry state. If I get pulled over, what's the best way to let an officer know I'm carrying without intensifying the moment? It's an excellent question, actually.
Yeah, that's the way I do it as a cop. I always have something on me, is I wait. Let him ask his question. I don't volunteer anything. How you doing, sir? Yes, license, registration, proof of insurance. Yes, sir, I'm getting my license. Just to let you know, in my glove box, I am a retired police officer. I do have a gun. So I don't blurt it out at first, because then it kind of gets everybody a little nervous.
Yeah, I've got a gun.
Right, yeah. So my hands are on the wheel. I let him ask me for my, or whatever he's going to say. I let him start the conversation. And then, I politely and easily say, hey, by the way, in my dashboard, I have this.
Well, I carry mine on my person almost everywhere I go all the time for, let's see, the last 19 or so years, mm-hmm. give or take. So about two decades.
Can I just add something, really?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
People ask cops all the time, what's the best gun? Should I get a 45? Should I get a 40? What is the best gun? Which is more? The best gun is the gun you take with you every day.
Yeah.
I don't give a shit what gun it is. But the one that you don't leave on your shelf, because it's the day that you're going to just the supermarket that or something, trivial, that is when you're going to get into trouble. So, you're thinking, oh, I'm going to go to this rally, or I'm going to go to this political event. It's going to be dangerous. That's when I need my gun. You need your gun when you least expect it.
Yeah.
So the best gun is the one that you're going to actually take with you every day.
I agree. Yeah. My girlfriend asked me the other day, like, do you really need your gun just to go walk the dogs? I'm like, I don't know when I'm going to need it.
Yeah.
That's why I always have it, right? But anyways, that's a very good point. Whenever I get into those situations and I have a confrontation, not a confrontation, but an interaction with a police officer and I'm carrying a weapon, you give them options. Like, hey, I've got concealed carry weapon on me right now. You mean to get out of the car or anything? Or what do you mean to do? Almost every time when I say that, they're like, nah, just sit there. You're fine. Like, if you just let it, nobody lets you know they have a gun before they use it on you. Typically,
yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's just not how that works. So I would say more communication is better than less communication. And look, there, you have no reason to be nervous. I've also had a situation actually on Fort Bragg on a military base where I had a gun, and I got out of the vehicle and they're fucking, they just took the weapon out, put it on the back, looked up serial number, make sure it didn't match anything. And I'm like, all right, cool. Can I go? Like, yeah. So just stay calm. There's no reason to freak out about that situation. And if you are calm and communicate with the police, they're not going to fucking freak out about it either.
The other thing, too, that you don't know about Dan is the gun he's talking about is a little Derringer, very much like the McCloskeys in St. Louis. So it's like that woman had.
It's really
dainty.
It looks like the noisy cricket from Men in Black.
Yeah, I mean, but
totally
really,
kidding,
in,
by the way.
In reality, for a regular citizen in a concealed carry, I mean, you shouldn't be getting into, I mean, there is now, we have active shooters. You shouldn't be getting into 200-yard firefights. That means you had a chance to retreat. This is up close and personal, and having an up close and personal gun is a really good thing.
Yeah, I carry a Glock 43 or 43X, depending on the day.
It's usually on the desk.
Well, it feels comfortable today, so okay. I didn't take it out.
Good.
I didn't eat a big breakfast, I guess.
Good. How bad was gang violence when you were working down there?
Yeah, it was, we have in our neighborhood, we had Haitian gangs, and it got pretty violent. And a lot of it was just because they were fighting each other. They weren't coming after cops. They were just randomly shooting each other wherever they would see each other. So, sadly, and I remember, there was a couple of shootouts in my city, and then couple of gang members got killed, and at his funeral, it was on the news, but on his funeral, someone showed up with an Uzi at a funeral and just opened up on the people in there. So when you're that far past rules, it is every man for himself.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can imagine, at a certain point, Are you just like, all right, look, man, you guys are going to shoot it out, and then maybe I'll come in like 30 seconds later after all this bullshit is done? Like, has that ever been the case?
Yeah, I mean, I wish if we were in a big open desert, and but you know, there's just such chance for a bystander to get hit, and you know, we're a really crowded city. I worked in the city of Aventura. We're really packed in, crowded city, big, one of the biggest malls in the country, one of the busiest malls.
Yeah.
Probably more banks than any area in all of Miami. So when you want to rob, you come to Aventura to do a bank robbery. When you want to do credit card fraud, you would come to Aventura. You know, South Florida was already the credit card fraud capital of the world. And Aventura, I mean, for a small police department, I would say we would average 20 arrests a day. And we're real small, 130-man police department. Shouldn't be that high, but it was busy.
Well, all those banks were built by drug dealers back in the 70s because all that didn't exist until they needed a place to put their money. And it was like, great, let's build another bank and another bank and another bank down there. Let me ask you about street fighting, because that era was also like Kimbo Slice and Jorge Masvidal and all that stuff. Did you ever get called to like a backyard brawl fight, one of those things?
No, not in Aventura. I never saw one of those. But I wish I did.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you let that go on? Because it seemed organized enough where you're like, fuck it. Like, they seem to be policing themselves enough.
I mean, I worked growing up. I played college ball in Long Island. And just, you know, I had to pay my own way through school. So I worked as a bouncer for 4 years in some rough places. And I always thought the best philosophy is let people work it out themselves for the most part, you know, less government, less security, less people, let people work things out and get it out of their system, and everything will be fine.
I think you meant to say Strong Island on that one. So I'll just go ahead and correct you. Everybody I've met from Long Island's always tell me it's Strong Island. What made you want to move down to Florida in the first place? Just to get the fuck out of there?
I was a good kid for a while, and then in my teens I started becoming a little bit of a wild kid. I kind of had enough self-awareness that I knew that, you know, there's a lot of things in my neighborhood were going bad. A lot of people, you know, my friends were getting into a lot of trouble. I had that self-awareness. So I was working for a trucking company. They needed a supervisor. I was working in New Jersey, and they needed a supervisor in Miami. And I had that self-awareness to know I was going down a bad path. And I honestly, in my heart, believe that's what makes a really good cop, is a guy who wasn't perfect and, you know, in school, and a person who made mistakes. Because like Dan was saying earlier, I'm more proud of all the people I didn't arrest. I'm more proud of all those kids that I caught with a little bit of herb, a little bit, you know, before herb is cool, and just say, guys, just dump that shit on the street and get the fuck out of here. You know, I'm more proud of that. The people I didn't put handcuffs on. I mean, I did put some handcuffs on some really bad people, but I think I'm more proud of it. I remember there was a time I was transporting to the jail, and I was thinking to myself, man, I've transported in Aventura. We would have to transport. It was almost an hour drive. I've transported thousands and thousands of people, and it doesn't seem to make a change. You know, we're doing our job, and it just seems so those people that I actually could help by not arresting, I felt pretty good. And then, you know, you check up on them and say, hey, you know, you're doing good. You know, I gave you that break. What are you doing with that break?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I understand. And, you know, shit, I think for the most part, everybody else is like you. To be honest with you, every cop that I've met is pretty much like you.
Yeah, because they don't want to do fucking paperwork for no reason.
Yeah.
Dude, and Jesus
when it's
Christ.
Like, when you can just tell somebody to dump that fucking, you know, half ounce of
weed. I mean, there's even, you know, like, you know, we always know about the paperwork. And the crazy thing about the paperwork is it tripled in my time, in my 20 years. It tripled, where you'd write a few forms, and then there was a form to protect the form, and there was a form, did you show the person the form? So then the forms got tripled. And then transporting people, you know, as soon as you bring them into the jail, or especially with a juvenile, there was 100 list question of, did this happen to you? Did that happen? Did the cop say something to you? Did you get hurt? Did the cop tase you? And then based on that, the jail would try to force you to take them to a hospital to get checked out. And I mean, one arrest, you could be with a guy for 12 hours. You're not eating. You have things in jail called lockdown, where you're transporting a prisoner. You're going to the jail. There's a fight and there's a lockdown. You're in that jail now for however long. Call a girlfriend and say, you know, I'm not going to be home tonight. I'm I'm in jail tonight. I'm stuck in lockdown.
Oof. And she's going to Olive Garden with somebody else, my man. I tell you what, I want to get to your story about the giant killer here and follow up on it. We've got some sponsors that pay for the shit wagon to be on the air. So if you'll forgive me, David, I'm just going to read them real quick, because that's the only reason all of us are here. GhostBed.com/drinking bros. 40% off Labor Day sale. That is a bundle package. That is the adjustable base. You can couple that with a mattress and all the goodies there. Pillows, sheets, pillow toppers, you name it. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros today. Or you can get 30% off everything in the entire store by using the promo code drinkingbros at checkout if you just want singular items, like a mattress or just the pillows by themselves or the sheets. I recommend all of them because it's the most comfortable bedding I've ever had in my entire life. And I love that mattress more than my wife. Almost. It's close. As always, they get a 36-month pay-as-you-go program there if you have decent credit. And you can couple all those deals together with the deals I named above, and you can walk out of there with a mattress set for like $35 to $38 a month. Congratulations. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros today to hop on that Labor Day deal. Next up, we've got getroman.com/drinkingbros, where today, if you're prescribed, you're going to get 50% off your first month of ED treatment. Not that you have it, David. I can tell. I can sense you got a strong boner over there, my man. But the world's back up for most of the people, and that means new horizons. So whether you've been in a relationship for years or just getting started and are excited to get back out there and meet new people, when the moment comes, you want to be ready. Roman ready. Go to GetRoman.com/drinkingbros today to talk to a U.S. licensed healthcare professional. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for erectile dysfunction, all from the comfort and privacy of your own home. Roman ready equals confidence. The confidence you know you can rise to the occasion of the moment. When you're looking at the summer of love, which is what we're in, Giorgio, shout out to you. I know you've had some success this summer. We met your girlfriend earlier in the week. Proud of you. I don't know if you're using it or not using it, but you got a smile on your face every day. You're coming into work, and we're proud of that, Giorgio. But if you do need it, a U.S. licensed professional healthcare worker will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, it ships to you for free within a 2-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward, convenient, and discreet. Getting started is simple. Just go to GetRoman.com/drinkingbros and complete an online visit. Take care of your ED without leaving your own home. Complete an online visit today to connect with a U.S. licensed healthcare professional and take care of it. Go to GetRoman.com/drinkingbros today. And if you're prescribed, get 50% off your first month of ED treatment. Make sure you're ready to have confidence and control the summer. Get Roman ready. Last but not least, we got PureJerkyCo.com. Finest jerky in the lands. Get 4 packs for $25, 8 for $50. Use the promo code DRINKINGBROS at checkout for 10% off at purejerkyco.com. This box that is right in front of me is 70, and that is nice. 2 flavors by one of the most famous chefs in Austin. We've paired up with a local company here in Austin, Texas. For their jerky, go to purejerkyco.com. Promo code DRINKINGBROS will get you 10% off. And subscribe if you love it as much as we do. I get it shipped to my house, so these assholes don't eat it. Now, I want to follow up on this giant killer story that you chatted with about Dan earlier on in the year here. You met him while you were on patrol in Miami. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would run into him on the street and started a little bit of a friendship for about 15 years before he dropped the bomb on me, saying that he was the smallest man ever served in the military.
Did you believe him at first? Because he was homeless.
Absolutely not. Yeah, he was absolutely not. I thought he was delusional. You know, I felt a little bad because guy that I would talk about world politics with. So I felt a little bad, and I was like, you know, but I speak to a lot of people that come in and out of consciousness where they're delusional sometimes. So I just thought it was, never heard of a 4'9" Green Beret. It didn't make sense.
And when did you finally confirm this story?
Well, no, after he told me, I did go check it online. I almost didn't, but when I got home that night, he was just so convincing, and he had his facts and dates down. I was like, let me just look in case there's some crazy chance he was in the Coast Guard or something. And yeah, and then all the,
I like how you're shitting on the Coast Guard.
No.
It would have been fine if he was driving the boat.
Merchant Marines, whatever it is. I apologize. So, you know, I checked him on Google and man, stories started popping up. Smallest man joins the military.
And so what happens after that? Because obviously you read this guy's life story. He's homeless. Do you offer to help him out? How does the rest of your relationship unfold once you know that he's telling the truth?
Well, throughout the years, I did try to get him off the street. And we have in Florida a thing called the Baker Act law, which if he's a danger to himself or to others, I can force him into a facility to get mental health. But he never met the criteria. So, you know, I would ask him every once in a while, and he was a very private guy, and he was very proud. And he was taking care of himself. He was feeding himself. He did live on the street, but he wasn't a danger to himself or to anyone else. So there's not much more I can do about that. But after he told me, I just was blown away. And I mean, I just said to him, hey man, I don't know how, but would you be interested in sharing your story, the story with the world? Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, you know, and that me and him would meet up every day and I would take notes, because my initial idea was I would find a real filmmaker, a real writer, and pass this information on. But I didn't know he was going to get killed within 10 days. He got hit in a hit and run. And,
When he got killed, let me ask you this, and I apologize for asking this, but I feel obligated to. Did you think it was at all suspicious based on what he did in his former career?
Yes. Well, to break it down, so you know, after he told me about the Green Beret stuff, he did tell me about an undercover operation he did with the ATF, which, okay, so the first part was true, but this isn't true. You know, I work with the ATF, and I took down the biggest weapon smuggling ring to ever leave Fort Bragg. And I was like, eh. So, you know, I tracked down the ATF agent that he claims he worked with. Took me a couple of days. And this was on Friday, May 8th, in the afternoon. And I cold called the guy through law enforcement contacts. And lo and behold, the guy says, everything Flaherty told you is the truth. We couldn't have got that case done without him. I became agent of the year. It was our biggest, you know, take on explosives and weapons being smuggled out of Fort Bragg. And then it was that night that Flaherty gets killed. And Flaherty did kind of warn me when he told me about it. He said, just don't look into it. It's not going to be good for your career. And it probably won't be good for my health. And I didn't think anything. So of course, when I got that knock on my door, 4 o'clock in the morning by one of my guys saying, hey, Dave, sorry to tell you, your friend Flaherty was just killed. You know, I'm like, oh my God, I did it. I shouldn't have made that call. Extraordinary accusations need extraordinary proof. There's so many bizarre things that happened that the woman who ran him over did. It's just, there's so much bizarreness to the story. Anything is possible.
Did you get a chance to chat with her individually?
No, I mean, so you know, I any investigator, if you really have a connection to the case, you have to take yourself off. So I couldn't personally investigate the case. One of my friends, a traffic homicide investigator, did. He interviewed her. My sergeants, you know, the traffic homicide sergeants interviewed her. The whole thing in the end fell apart. The state attorney's office, based in, you know, we brought them a mountain of evidence that she should be charged, said, nah, you know, there's a Supreme Court case that says that, you know, she didn't have any knowledge that she hit a human being, and, you know, she's fine. No ticket, no charges.
Well, look, at 4-9, I hate to say it, but you know, there's a good shot she didn't see him, you know?
Well, but okay. But he bounced over the hood, his head smashed into her window, broke her window. It bent the A-frame. He flew 20 feet. His shoes flew off.
Right.
You know, you hit a dog, you know, you hit a 100-pound person, and he had a big, his big backpack, his big rucksack on his back. It went flying. Papers went flying. She walked back to the crime scene twice.
And then took off afterwards?
After she ran him over, she drove home, which was only a couple of blocks away. I have video of her walking around checking her car, and there was blood and hair on the car. So how could she say she didn't know? She walked back to the crime scene. I interviewed the firemen who were first on scene, because a bunch of joggers found him. And said that his body was visible, because she claimed she wanted to see if she ran into what she hit. She thought she hit a barricade or something. So that was her only reason to walk back to the crime scene. But she certainly didn't see a body laying there. And part of his body was a little obscured in the bushes, but the other half of his torso was easily visible. from what the fireman said from 20 yards away or 10 yards away. So that's another weird one. Then the next morning, she goes back to the crime scene where there's all the yellow tape, all my detectives are working. She melds into the crowd, looks, doesn't say a peep to any of us. Doesn't say, hey, I might have been involved, nothing. She goes back to her place of work because she worked for Miami-Dade Homicide as a court stenographer.
Oh, boy. Oh, wow. Back.
Yeah, she worked for another police department. She went there, talked to her supervisor and said, hey, there's a chance I might have been involved in this. You know, you want to call Aventura PD on my behalf? So she got all the ducks in a row. Now, she was famous. She became famous, not for killing my friend, but she became famous about 8 months ago for a viral video. She got drunk in Boca Raton and was wearing a Miami Homicide jacket screaming anti-Semitic stuff. So the video went worldwide viral and people know her from that. They, you know, they see her wearing a police jacket and yelling about Jews.
Yeah, so she's pretty stable.
Sokolov.
Yeah, Sokolov. Don't most people, though, return to the scene of the crime? Isn't that like a police thing? Like I've heard that. My wife watches murder docs all the time. So
that's
like,
her name, Leslie Sokolov.
Leslie Sokolov. Don't most people who are guilty kind of return to the scene for some weird reason? You'll be able to explain that better than I will.
Yeah, I mean, for a myriad of different reasons, you know, sometimes they just want to make sure that they covered their their tracks. They didn't leave anything on scene. Sometimes they're just they enjoyed it and they want to see what they did.
There's no instinct inside of you just to yell out, hey, you're the one that killed him. I see you right there. You're right in front of my face. Like you're right behind the barricade.
Well, remember, we had no idea who ran him over at that point in time.
Oh, I mean, it was an open homicide. Okay.
Yeah, it was only, you know, we were pulling video. We didn't have any of the video yet. We were pulling video from everywhere. We pulled a red light camera from a block away. So we saw the suspect vehicle. We saw it was a Prius. You know, that's another thing. If you're driving maybe, you know, a Toyota, you know, a Tundra or something.
Yeah.
But she was driving a Prius when she hit him. So I think she knew. So we had forensic evidence on scene of car parts. So we were making matches, you know, matching things up when we got the call that, you know, she was ready to turn herself in.
Prius is a silent killer, you know?
Yeah.
I dated somebody with a Prius. That fucking thing didn't make a goddamn noise.
Yeah, it's quiet.
Very quiet.
So this Richard Flaherty, who served in Vietnam, was a special forces operator, left the military and worked for the government in some capacity for a while. He dies in the middle of unloading. I believe it was 2 weeks after he started talking to you about his experiences. Is that correct?
Yeah, 10 days.
Okay, so 10 days. And you take the story, put it together, do your research, and the book The Giant Killer is published, and this gentleman that we're going to hear the audio from later, he comes to you after that.
Yeah, actually he saw the documentary first.
Okay.
And the thing with the documentary is I had lots of suspicions of Richard working for different agencies, but I wanted that documentary to be completely black and white and no speculation. I think once or twice I kind of speculate that, you know, there's a lot more to the story, but I leave it pretty plain. So that's when all these people came out, you know, from around the world. And some people, I vetted so many people that just had crazy stories. And the vetting was the hardest part. But when this guy contacted us and he knew stuff, you know, intimately about Flaherty and places and dates and times and addresses and other friends, his story was pretty remarkable. It's kind of basically a deathbed confession. He said at the time of the interview that he had stage 4 cancer, and unfortunately he did pass a few months later. There's two parts to the audio. There's this bizarre, incredible, clandestine story he tells about his friend from the late 70s to the early 80s. And then there's this really heartfelt story that he talks about, which is, you know, it's applicable to today, about how many times the government let Flaherty down, that they used him and then discarded him, and top of Flaherty always fighting, people laughing at him for being 4'9", his own government, a country that he fought for many times, used him and abused him. But the important thing, I just want to close this up, is that Flaherty never lost hope for America. He never turned his back on America. You know, as many times as he was disappointed as a soldier, as working for the agency and all those things, he really always believed in, you know, that things will change and get better.
And the audio we're going to hear here tonight, when was this recorded?
I believe 3 years ago. I made contact with the guy, spoke to him a few times through emails. He was very hesitant to talk to him. My dad helped me with the project too. He was very hesitant to talk to us. He was in Los Angeles at the time. My dad was there. My dad asked if he would meet up with him. So my dad conducts the interview, and you can hear my dad asking him all the questions. Mm-hmm. But that's just a real lucky break that my dad actually was able to get that much of the story out of him. Otherwise, I mean, and there's still a million mysteries with Flaherty, but at least we have a little bit more understanding, and I can, his whole life is a puzzle. So the more little pieces you give me, the more I can start to put it together, even though there's a lot of missing pieces still. But collecting all these little shreds of stories and evidence and things I can check up on always help.
Right. And we got a few minutes left. Let's talk about some of those little pieces of information.
Yeah.
So he leaves Special Forces after Vietnam and apparently links up with the agency or some cutout for the agency and does what exactly? I mean, that time in American history, we were primarily operating in Eastern Europe and South America, right?
So, you know, the important part of the story is Flaherty, like many of the guys, and I think it was 1971, were all caught up in the RIF, the reduction in force.
Right.
Flaherty didn't want to leave the military ever. He told everyone that he only wanted to stay in the military for a career, and he wanted to train the new young guys on the lessons he learned in Vietnam and in Thailand and Laos, wherever else he was. That was his dream in life. The RIF back then, from the guys that I spoke to, they really described it as a real ugly being forced out of the military. So guys like Flaherty, his initial first jump back into work was private military contract work in Rhodesia and Angola. So, and there was a lot of other Vietnam vet guys there too. And a lot of them, some were there for money, and a lot of them felt it was to continue the fight against communism. Mm-hmm. There were Chinese and Russian advisors training guerrillas and even Cuban advisors there in Africa. And some of those guys felt that they just, you know, their commitment to continue the fight against communism, that's where they went.
And obviously there's the Sandinistas, right?
Yeah, so when he gets back, I did my little research. It all I believe when Carter came in, he started signaling that he wasn't going to support the Somozan government. Mm. So the U.S., just like in Afghanistan, you know, we realized this thing was about to collapse. The agency started trying to get their top government people out of the country, and Flaherty was asked to help. You know, offer support of providing weapons for the anti-Sandinistas.
I mean, the Sandinistas at the time, between 82 and 88, had declared a sick. I mean, they were under a quote unquote state of emergency for 6 consecutive years. That government had to, which obviously that is usually just a way for an authoritarian government to flex as hard as possible on the population.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was a time when we were doing a lot of things to try to get, you know, weapons and resources into the counter government forces, right? Mm-hmm. Just for context.
One thing Flaherty was adamant about was the lessons of Vietnam, that he did not want America to send their army and their military there. He always wanted that to be clandestine and special forces missions. Mm-hmm. He just felt that it would be a quagmire if we started sending large forces down there into the jungles.
Well, of course. I mean, look, let's be real frank about this. A bunch of white faces aren't going to liberate Iraq. They're not going to liberate Afghanistan. They're not going to liberate Nicaragua or any other country where the population is primarily brown, because it doesn't work that way.
Right.
Right. And it doesn't matter about the white or brown thing either. What really matters is that people have to fight for their own liberty. That is the number one rule that we should learn from the last 20 years of warfare, that if if they didn't come ask us to help, then we shouldn't help. Yeah. That's my opinion.
Yeah. David, look, we greatly appreciate you being on here today. Before we cut to the audio, and I forgive us for everybody who's watching the video right now, we're going to play this interview at the end of our audio show on Drinking Bros Podcast, which you can find on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Describe what the audience is going to hear tonight, David.
So just a quote, it is edited because he did mention some things that I wanted to pass on to my law enforcement. You know, the cases stay open for lots of years. So he did, in this conversation, pass on some information that I did had to redact. And also he calls Richard throughout the, apparently in the 70s, Richard always answered to the name Rick or Dick. He didn't answer the name Richard. So he'll call him Dick throughout. But otherwise, you'll hear him talking about his time with Flaherty in Africa and some of the clandestine things and how the agency, in his opinion, used and discarded Flaherty.
Okay, great. So everybody flip on over to the audio show. Again, the Drinking Bros Podcast. You can subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcast. Please rate the show a 5-star and leave a quick review. You will hear that interview now. In the meantime, we are going live with American Party here in less than 10 minutes on this YouTube channel. Subscribe if you're an audio listener and not familiar with the video to Drinking Bros Podcast on YouTube. And then over on Drinking Bros Sports, starting at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 2 p.m. Central, we'll be doing the Marathon Fantasy Football Draft. David, thank you so much for joining us today, man. You're a fascinating guy. This is a crazy story, and really looking forward to this interview.
Thank you so much, and God bless our vets.
Absolutely.
God bless them for everything they do for us.
Absolutely. For David Yuzik, D'Anthony Holloway, I'm Ross Patterson. We are the Drinking Bros Podcast. Good night, everyone.
Out of all the people that came forward, the person with the most intriguing information was a gentleman that we'll now refer to as Frank Sosa. We use this pseudonym to obviously protect his identity. Frank contacted us and told us that he spent a lot of time with Flaherty in the 70s and 80s, and he wanted to clear up some things that he saw in the documentary. My dad tried to get him on the phone many times, but he would only talk through emails. But eventually, my dad built a trust, and they eventually agreed to meet up for an interview. This interview you're about to hear is heavily edited for several reasons. One, to protect obvious people, other people's identities. Two, I kind of felt there is some information that is still government sensitive that Frank gave out that I don't think is proper to release. And the last thing is Frank just had a different way of telling a story. It was very nonlinear. He would bounce up and back, and it's just kind of hard to follow. And the last thing to note in this interview is Frank claimed that in the 70s and 80s, Richard would only answer to either the name Rick or Dick. So throughout most of the interview, he's calling Flaherty Dick. He also refers to Flaherty as the dwarf or dwarf, and that had to do with an advertising gimmick Flaherty used to do as a salesman for Bushmaster Rifles. He'd make up pencils and coffee mugs with the name the dwarf that he would hand out to clients. The following is the interview.
Okay, let me, if I may, just get a couple of things. Did you serve in the military?
No.
Not in the American military.
Okay, may I ask which military, or we can't say?
We can't say. It wasn't a military. It was a combat operations, but not in the military. Because of Dick.
Okay, now that
And being South Florida in the 70s. Okay, let me set this up for you real quick. First and foremost, okay? You say what you want about Dick. He was a patriot before anything else. We're in the gun shop, right? Rhodesia.
And that's a word we haven't heard yet.
We'll get to the Venezuela one. Okay, yeah, so I'm working in a bookshop. I think I explained
right.
This, right? And Norm, you know, Norm was a bastard of the highest repute. Okay, he's one of those guys. But he was a customer minding this bookshop. And he had a gun shop in Homestead at the time. Later on, he opened one in Davie, and that's the one I managed. And then there was two from Miami. Ramon D, who I met through Dick, who was a mercenary in Rhodesia, among other places in Africa, who had been a Vietnam vet, who ended up in Leavenworth for killing the people. His claim to fame was he would use an aluminum baseball bat with a plastic cover over it, which is how they used to come back then, and he'd beat you to death with it, drop the cover, take the bat with him, and throw it away somewhere. Okay? And they finally caught up with him. He was doing it for, he would say, corporate assassination.
Right.
But it was various agencies from places around the world he had been.
So you meet Dick.
Actually, when we first started socializing was those big dinners he was doing in that Coral Rock house. But before that, it was just Dick coming in the shop and we'd talk and go get a bagel and a coffee or something.
It shows another dimension that he would, you know, befriend somebody.
No, no. Dick's never befriended anybody in his life. Okay? Look, Dick was a little paranoid. Now, just because you're paranoid, that doesn't mean you don't have enemies. Okay?
Yeah.
And some of those enemies could be enemies that you self-made.
Okay? Right.
You said something, let me explain something to you. You said something to me on the phone that everybody looks at Dick in a different way. No. You're 180 degrees out of phase, bro.
You think?
Yeah, totally. Dick presents a different Dick to everybody.
Okay.
It's a different thing.
I understand what you're saying. So you meet Dick. What was he... Here, this is from what you sent me. Okay. And I... At the time he had been working for the post office, a job he got a check for, but never showed up.
Right.
How was that done?
That would have been the agency.
So you're saying that he worked for the agency?
As a contract employee, as do most people who work for the agency. Most people who work for the agency don't work directly for the government. They're not a GS-14, and they don't get a check from the United States Treasury. They work under contract. Plausible deniability.
Okay.
At least back in those days.
Okay.
Not only CIA, other nations as well. I know he's worked for Venezuelans. I know he's worked for some African potentates. I know he's worked for himself. I know he's worked for the agency. He would fly over to Thailand, mostly, and Costa Rica.
Didn't see that on his passport.
I got to work Africa and I didn't even have a passport. He spent 8 years flying around the world. Dubai, Saudi, South America, Australia, all over America, okay? And he would bring the hardware and software for that entity to do the wiretapping, okay? Here's the fun part. Every time he flies in, of course, we'd get together. So he's flying into Long Beach. Okay, I'll pick you up. Nah, man, pick me up. You can come down and say hi, but I got to go with them. Okay, so I come down, and I don't know if you've ever been to Long Beach Airport. It's like 1950.
Yeah.
You walk down the stairs, you know, out on the tarmac, right? Okay?
Yeah.
So it's like Casablanca or something, weird thing going on here, right? It just wasn't night and foggy. He gets down the plane, and there's a couple guys that are just so obviously FBI or Secret Service or, you know, the black suit, white shirt, little black narrow tie. Remember now, this is, you know, not that long ago. And they grab him up and put him in a SUV, a Chevy Suburban, and or Yukon or whatever it was, black, and off they go, right? How he got the drugs in. Innovative thinking. That time, if an airplane deviated coming up from South America, deviated from its flight plan,
right,
the least bit, or dropped below an altitude, they would scramble jets out of Homestead Air Force Base. Okay, because there's little airfields, landing, not airfields, but landing strips. I mean, they land on the levees, like the C-25 levee and stuff. Okay, sure. Well, but he could jump. He could do halo. You know what halo is?
Yeah, high altitude.
Low altitude.
Yeah.
Okay. So they would fly. He could carry 7 keys. That was his max out for the shoot he had. Okay. That's a lot of coke. Okay. You're looking at what? 15 and a half pounds? That's a lot of coke, man. Do a takeoff, set a flight plan, and fly out over the Everglades, and I got the keys to the right-of-ways and all that, and I also have this big, badass 600 horsepower Ford 4x4, okay? And I've got a small swamp boat. So we go out, and there's no GPS or anything in those days, right? And it is black. Okay, there is no ambient light. And they would not do this on full moon nights. And you'd hear, once in a while you'd hear the airplane. Most often you did. And you'd just be sitting there, and all of a sudden you'd hear, shoot him. But that's innovative there, buddy. And that's how you got away with it for so long. There was no way to tell. No way to tell. None. He did stuff for the government. He did stuff for himself. But it was the same stuff. At the time, he got busted because he was doing a job. Okay? And he had a couple pounds, probably a key of coke in the freezer.
No, I'm government, not shocked.
Government, no, government interference. He goes to court. He gets 15 years. He goes to court again. It's 7 years. I might be off a year or two on the note dates. Okay. Yeah. Third time he goes, he gets 6 months work release. Judge, this is Colonel so-and-so. You know, come on, man. You don't go from 15 years to work release on the same charge after you've been convicted. That's not happening. If that's not obvious government involvement, I don't know what is.
Right.
And that's, at the time, Norman told them that Dick was working for him. Okay? Which Dick wasn't working for Norm. He ended up back at the post office after that, by the way.
He never spoke to you about special forces or Thailand? He did.
Yeah, he told me he was there. Again, he never gave specifics because he's not supposed to. Okay? He did say things like, hey, you know how they're saying we're over there training people?
Bullshit.
He worked with the, how do you pronounce it, the Hmong?
Oh, the Hmong, okay. H-M-O-N-G.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Right.
He was working with them in Thailand and a little bit in Cambodia.
In Special Forces Thailand, then I interviewed the guy on the phone, and he said, the only thing we did in Special Forces was we trained the Royal Thai Police. That was all we did.
Yeah, and Nixon didn't bomb outside of South Vietnam, right?
Come on, man. But I think this guy is still connected, and that's why he couldn't talk.
Even if he's not connected, he shouldn't say a damn thing.
Yeah, but...
Okay, he signed a contract saying that he would agree to say this and not say that, and that's what he has to live by. Okay? And what Dick does to everybody is he was doing it. He tests everybody. You know what Dick was almost like? You know the Mad Magazine, Spy versus Spy?
Sure.
And they're always,
yeah.
That's Dick. When he'd leave his house, he'd do little telltales on the doors. When he parked his car, I mean, it was like he was on a mission. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365. Nobody can live like that. We're sitting on the boat one night, and he's like, God damn it, Tim. God damn it. What's the matter, Dick? He says, I'm built large. I'm just short. And that was part of his, like I told you, he was frustrated in life because he was who he was. He was the guy that could be a war hero. He saw himself as a big guy. And he was. He was a small stature. And here's the sad part. And this is what used to tear me up, man. We'd be sitting out on the boat. He liked being out on the boat off the intercoastal out in the bay a little bit because he felt comparatively safe. He'd make me kill all the lights except for a couple running lights, which you have to have. Okay, otherwise you get run over. And he could see anybody coming up on him from any direction. Right. We're 11 miles offshore, off of Turkey Point usually. And it's a nuke power plant down there. That's when he would break down and start telling me things. And again, I keep using the same word, frustrated. Here's a guy that could talk to you on any subject or issue you could imagine. He could talk to you about John Locke, Rousseau, Greek philosophers, the religion, various religions, art. Just amazing, okay?
Yeah.
And a great cook, by the way. I don't think most people know that, but Dick could really cook up some nice food. And the few times I was with him when women were involved, the women seemed really happy afterwards, okay? So he was probably pretty good in that area, too. And that's what made it so sad, because if they'd given him some opportunity, they got a gem here. Yeah. And I think his life would have gone...
different direction.
Not totally, but at least veered.
When you were with him, very heavy drinker?
Dick could outdrink you, me, that guy, and four other guys under the table any day of the week. He took no pleasure from it, that I could see. I never saw him but a couple, three times to where you would say, that guy's drunk. And all those times was on the boat. We're hitting back. In those days, it was wild turkey and beers. So I'm out in the Glades. Okay, at the time, I had already worked as a groundman and had gotten the apprenticeship. And then Lord Power and Light went on strike, so they shut everything down on the contract side. That's how I ended up in the bookshop and the gun shops. Okay, so that's where I would demonstrate the Bushmaster. And it wasn't just the Bushmaster. In those days, the Bushmaster was a bullpup with the stock that swiveled. Okay, it was the non-parallax sight that came with it, which was a true technological advancement for the day. Now they're commonplace, but this was the first. Okay, that's a big deal. And so I'd put on my BDUs, and we'd go out there. The time that sticks in my mind most is a bunch of Venezuelan officers, majors, colonels. You'd see the general back at the hotel down in Miami Beach or South Miami. A lot of special forces guys, and I don't know if you know what was going on in Venezuela in the 70s. It wasn't El Salvador, but it was right-wing juntas, and okay. I don't know if you know this, and I don't know if it's that way now, but during the Vietnam era, officers worked under a contract, not an enlistment per se.
Right, I understand that. Okay. Yeah, and they didn't rehire him.
So they won't renew his contract, right? But then they come to him with these offers.
Right.
You know, the agency and the ATF. Now, he didn't expect to remain a captain.
Right.
He expected to be an officer, but not a captain, okay? And he thought he'd have, you know, a career in the military, and he'd work his way back up to whatever he could get to. And that was going to be his life. And he always wanted to, after Vietnam was wound down, wanted to do something in training for the next bunch of guys.
Right.
Okay, I mean, he told me that more times than I can remember. And he was really mad they didn't. Now then after that, look what the government did. When they needed him to do something that they didn't want their people to do, hey, Dick, how you doing, buddy? Good, buddy. How are you, man? Okay, and then when it's over...
Gotcha.
I'm telling you, every time we go to a bar, and not just bars, okay? You go to the 7-Eleven. You go to a burger stand. You go to a Denny's. It didn't matter. And you'd be sitting there, and here comes the dwarf. And you could see as he'd walk by, people go like... No, it's the 70s. Nobody was what they say today, woke. Now, I'm trying to think.
No,
this guy's a dyed-in-the-wool war hero that overcame not only his stature, but congressional approval. He's doing things that his government wants him to do that the government's saying aren't being done, right? And he comes home, even his own military would take a look at him and go, bullshit. I've been with Dick, and we're going to the PX, and we get up to the gate. He's got his ID, right? Get out of here. What do you mean, get out of here? Now, I'm coming unglued, right? Dick says, I'm coming unglued. Do you know who this is? This is a captain in the Green Berets, 3 tours in Vietnam. Get to attention, you piece of shit. You know? And then somebody, usually another guy, would come out of the shack. And he'd go, let me see that. He'd look at the ID and he'd look at the dwarf and he'd go, you know? Now think how that would hit a guy.
No, I got it.
And he'd be in town 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks. And he'd start pacing like a tiger in a cage. And he'd gather up his crap, throw it in his truck, run out in the glades, live basically off the land. Yeah. But he's over the house one night, over the apartment one night. He was telling me, he goes, how do you stand this? It's like being in jail. The only time I've seen Dick happy.
Okay.
Was in that Coral Rock house. And he'd throw those parties, those gourmet dinners. He'd invite people over and there'd be people painting, you know, art. Or there'd be musicians.
Right.
And he was the king of his castle. I'm convinced that it was those nights on that boat that, I don't want to say he warmed up to me. I don't know that Dick warmed up to anybody. Because there's always a big piece of Dick that is just never going to trust you. It's like that Coral Rock house again.
Yeah.
Okay? In that vegetation. He had perimeters set up. You know, which I assume is the same thing he did in Vietnam. You know? He'd cut little paths to where his perimeters were set up so he could see if anything had happened. And I didn't do 1/10 of the crap that Dick did. So yeah, it's a mindset, man. But I don't think Dick's ever spent, since he left Vietnam, a happy period of time in his life.
Yeah.
Everywhere he goes, it never stops. He's demeaned, looked at with disgust. Now, if he was some smuck, who cares? But he wasn't.
Right.
He's a erudite. Philosophical. Extremely intelligent. Carries out the yin-yang. Tried and tested. Sure. American war hero. And he's getting treated everything in his life. Well, I couldn't have done it. I don't know why he didn't kill himself. Oh, he did have a huge ego.
Yeah.
I think part of the reason he could do some of the things he managed to do was his ego was big enough that in his mind, at 4 foot whatever, 98 pounds, being a Green Beret captain was no big deal. I don't even think he thought I'm 4'9". I think he just thought, I can do anything I want.
Okay. But yet he called himself the dwarf and he put it on the pencil.
Sales.
And
salesmanship.
Yeah, and the...
That's when he'd be smiling, laughing, give you the pencil, ha, 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 ha. Okay? You know? It's just that's his persona. Neil,
it's what you want.
For the grace of God, I don't know why I'm alive. One of my bigger fears... Okay, look. You want the honest to God's truth?
Yeah.
I don't have that many years left. 2, maybe. If I do 5, it's a goddamn miracle. Okay? I have had serious health issues over the last 5 years. In fact, my orthopedic surgeon and my oncologist cannot believe I'm still walking and doing the things I'm doing. Much less doing the things I'm doing.
Right.
Okay? They all thought I was going to be dead, you know, a few years back. I just don't need the hassle at this point. I've got to get my wife to Texas, where her sister is and where her younger son is. Our older boy is coming with us. I just want enough time that I can take care of the wife.
My dad's audio recording abruptly ends there, and sadly only 9 months later, Frank Sosa would lose his battle with cancer. If you're interested in seeing more of Frank Sosa's interview, the full comprehensive interview is noted in the Giant Killer book.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.